Hey everyone, it's Reed. Before we get started, 2023 is underway, and this gang is going to be the year where we build the army to save democracy in 2024. I need you to go to jointheunion.us and sign up. Gang, I know you're out there. We've recruited 65,000 of your fellow Americans, and I need you to join the ranks today. Go to jointheunion.us and get involved. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to The Lincoln Project. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm joined by Joshua Zeitz, historian, New York Times bestselling author, and contributing editor to Politico magazine. Josh has taught American history and politics at Cambridge, Harvard, and Princeton, and has written for a wide range of outlets, including The Washington Post, The LA Times, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. His upcoming book, Lincoln's God, How Faith Transformed a President and a Nation, is now available for pre-order wherever fine books are sold. Today, he's coming to us from Boston, Massachusetts. Josh, welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
So, Josh, let me ask you this. You know, obviously, President Lincoln is the namesake of our organization, and we spend a lot of time thinking about him and reading about him. And, you know, I just finished John Meacham's book about Lincoln as well, and the faith piece of it rises there, but it's one of those things, as you go through the beginning of it, that the United States was founded, I guess, by a bunch of Enlightenment era individuals. It wasn't a particularly religious country for a long time. And then sometime in the early 1830s, sort of religion just exploded. How do you go from 1776, 1789, sort of, again, Enlightenment values, to a highly evangelical country in the span of a lifetime?
In the span of half a century. I mean, it's remarkable. And I think you've isolated exactly the right question. There are a couple of explanations for this. There are two things that are happening at the same time in the three or four decades following the Revolution and the Constitution. On one hand, you have the development of a market society, a market economy. You know, what had been really a collection of colonies in which you had cities and towns that hugged the seacoast and then tons of subsistence communities that lived outside of that web. Suddenly, there's a transportation revolution. First, it's roads, then it's canals, and later it's railroads. Those bring markets together. They bring people in greater connectivity to each other. And you get the rise of American capitalism as we know it today. Rising up alongside that is this evangelical Protestant awakening, right? It's the Second Great Awakening. And it really kind of begins in the late 1790s. And it hits its crescendo in the late 20s and early 30s. And by the 1830s, America is a fundamentally Christian country. It's a fundamentally Protestant country. And among Protestants, evangelical denominations enjoyed the largest growth and the largest amount of affinity. The Methodists, Baptists, Disciples of Christ, smaller but equally, if not more influential in some cases, were the Congregationalists and Presbyterians. They all share a number of tenets, but their religious enthusiasm and fervor would not only have been unrecognizable to the founders, it would have been disturbing. They viewed themselves in many cases as deists. And I think one way that historians have wrapped their heads around this is that you've got a tremendous amount of demographic change, demographic movement, economic activity in this new market economy. There are winners and losers, and there's a need for self-discipline that didn't occur on a self-subsistent farm. It's just a very different world, and it can create a lot of anxiety and confusion and enthusiasm. Evangelical Protestantism gives people a framework to understand their place in that world. And I think if you're going to isolate the one piece of connectivity here, it's that in the kind of subsistence economy that Abraham Lincoln grew up in, you know, in Indiana and before that in Kentucky, his father was a subsistence farmer because there was no access to markets and roads. So there was no point in really kind of producing more than you could consume at home. In that world, you were really, you know, what was going to happen was going to happen. And no amount of industry or ambition or personal agency was going to change the fact that, you know, the crops either grew or they didn't grow that year. And there was nowhere else to turn. You know, in a market economy, and also in a thriving democratic society, I guess that's the third piece. You get the market economy, evangelical Protestantism, and the rise of popular democracy. In that world, people have agency. They have agency over how they want to conduct their lives economically, what jobs they want to do, how hard they want to work, and how much risk they want to take on. They have agency now in politics. They can decide who they want running the state, running the town, running the country. And you see this turn away from an older Protestant ethos, which de-emphasized personal agency, a predestination. You know, most Protestants before the 1800s really believed in predestination. They believed that people were either born or not born as the elect, as the saved. Well, there's this rising wave of Methodist preachers and Baptist preachers and eventually Presbyterians and Congregationalists and Disciples of Christ. And they're preaching that, no, in fact, you have the ability to be saved. If you decide to be converted, if you welcome Christ into your life, if you lead a life of good works and faith, you can secure your own election. And so I think that that's the fundamental shift that you see, where people suddenly realize that in politics and religion, in the economy, they have power, they have authority. And so they grow up together, and you can't really disentangle one from the other.
So it's this interesting sort of braid of religion, economy, and politics. And you could even say that the roads, the canals, and the railroads created sort of almost a religious capitalism. And I mean, think about it. If you're born and you grow up being told whether you go to hell or not, whether you go to heaven or not, really not up to you. You got nothing to do. But then you have folks come in and say, no, 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 no. You actually can be saved. I mean, that's a hell of a lot more marketable, I think, Josh, don't you?
That's right, exactly that. And what's interesting is that there were foreign visitors to the United States in the first two or three decades of the 19th century, you know, including Tocqueville, but some lesser known ones, Harriet Martineau, and they all sort of remarked, they said, capitalism seems to run like wildfire. People are obsessed with business, with banks, with money in the United States in a way that seemed very odd to a European. And they also noted at the same time that churches were springing up alongside it. And they couldn't quite put their finger on why the two were happening at the same time, but they often remarked on it in the same paragraph. And that is very true. You saw ministers and congregations essentially having to sell their understanding of the world in the same way that people would sell goods and products. I mean, these two things rose up together. And really, that emphasis on personal agency and the ability of people to choose their own fate in this world and the next was the connectivity. And it's no coincidence that the places where evangelical revivalism burned the brightest, these so-called burnt over districts, burnt over because, you know, there was this sort of fiery enthusiasm for religion, these were places like Rochester, New York, or Ohio's Western Reserve. Places where the canals got there first, where the railroads got there first, where there was a thriving market economy. These were the places that were really the first locus of evangelical Protestantism, more than the sort of hinterlands where the market hadn't yet, you know, incurred. Now, this was not universally the case, but it was very clear that evangelical Protestantism thrived earliest and just strongest in those places where the market had already kind of risen up.
I want to get to Lincoln in that context first, but also you note, and I think it's the appropriate description, that this was a Christian nation. Yes, there were Sephardic Jews, maybe there were Catholics, but this was a Christian nation. There weren't really a lot of options, and everybody went to church. And if you were willing to, I don't know if it was tithe or take certain oaths, you could be a member of that church. But even if you weren't a member, most people still showed up.
So there are enormous rates of church membership and church attendance in this period. The churches themselves create these vast networks of philanthropic organizations and, you know, newspapers and magazines. At one point, essentially the number of people employed by the Methodist Church, either as clergy or in its affiliated organizations, were roughly the same as, if not a little bit more, than the number of postal employees in the U.S. And that seems like a weird factoid, but at that time, the postal service was really the primary way through which individuals, you know, interface with the federal government, and it was actually the largest agency of the federal government. So, but in every which way, this was a period in which, you know, Protestant churches, Protestant clergy enjoyed an enormous amount of influence. And, you know, I hesitate to say, was it a Christian nation in the sense that today, you know, many conservatives will say, well, we're a Christian nation, and they mean something very specific by that. But to your point, if you're talking about what was the predominant culture and faith in the United States at that point, it was Christianity and it was Protestantism as well. Although, obviously, in the beginning of the 1820s and 30s, you began to see enormous waves of immigrants from Germany and Ireland who were Catholic as well. And you saw a second large wave of Jews coming from Central Europe, Ashkenazic Jews, starting in the 1830s and 40s. But to your point, it was an overwhelmingly Protestant country, very uniform and homogenous.
So let's talk about Lincoln for a second. So as you note, Lincoln's father, Thomas, is a subsistence farmer and not a particularly successful guy in farming or business. He progressively owned less land throughout his life. Lincoln and his father had a strained relationship. His mother died, obviously, when he was young. He had a stepmother. But this was also a guy who, you know, like Lincoln was tall, he was strong, You know, he was a rail splitter. He could go out and, you know, work in the field with the best of them, but this was never what he wanted. And I think that in the hagiography, if that's the right word, of Lincoln, we sometimes forget that, yeah, I mean, he has this hard scrabble existence and upbringing, but maybe it smooths over the incredible ambition he had. He wanted to get the hell out and he never wanted to go back.
That's exactly right. I mean, there were two things that he most wanted to escape. One was his parents' intense religiosity, and the second was the life of a subsistence farmer that his father led. And in his mind, I think, and you know, it's always difficult to draw these lines with Lincoln because he left very little personal record. And you have to really be careful when you scrutinize all of the postmortem memories of Lincoln, because they were often, you know, misremembered decades later or remembered with a particular agenda in mind. But, you know, I think in his mind, he associated his parents' predestinarian Baptist faith. They were hardshell Baptists. They believed in predestination. They were still adherents of the old Westminster Confession. You know, that sort of belief in predestination and fatalism and the lack of ambition he perceived in his father, the lack of drive, the lack of assertion of personal agency, he disliked both of them and he wanted to move as far as he could from both of them. And in his early years, he certainly did.
And I guess my question is, Lincoln is as unique a president as we've had for various reasons, but would that have been a unique mindset as well at that time in America?
Certainly the desire to escape, you know, his parents' subsistence economy wouldn't have been, you know, there have been great historical studies done of fathers and sons of that generation. And he was hardly the only son to be really running up against his parents because, you know, they were born in a pre-market economy and they had certain ideas about the world. It wasn't just ideas about religion or about work. It was also about family and kinship. I mean, you know, families like the Lincolns built communities based on tight-knit kinship ties. They would bring cousins and second cousins and aunts and uncles with them every time they moved. They would build a bartering economy between them. You know, this was a world where families had to stay together in order to survive. I mean, they were born in that world, and Lincoln was born in a world where suddenly new advances in technology and transportation were opening up markets and creating opportunities for people like him to escape agriculture entirely and become lawyers or maybe to become commercial farmers. So it wasn't at all unusual for fathers and sons to butt up against each other because they were really straddling two worlds and having a hard time communicating. What was unusual was that Lincoln was a religious scoffer in his early years. He vocally rejected religion, mocked it privately and in some cases publicly, until he sort of learned to keep his mouth shut about it because it was hurting his early political prospects. But by all accounts, he was either an atheist or agnostic well until the moment he was elected president. And that was unusual because he was walking in a very different direction from the rest of the country. He could very well have said, I reject my parents' hardshell Baptist beliefs, and instead I'm going to embrace a version of Protestantism that really kind of aligns with my ambition and with my political beliefs, namely, you know, the sort of Whiggish political beliefs he holds. But he doesn't do that. He moves away from religion, which was a pretty iconoclastic position to hold in that time.
It is interesting, again, going back to this idea of ambition, he was a politician. And like all successful politicians, you have to take a hard look at the environment in front of you, the people that will elect you, at least in a democracy, and say, are there things that I have to do to get elected? Are there things that I have to say to get elected? And, you know, we can call that, in the words of Richard Ben Cramer, what it takes. Yes, he might have been an atheist, an agnostic, even you said a deist, like some of the founders were. But he understood very well the world in which he lived. And he said, okay, well, I have to make allowances for that. You even note that he wasn't a particularly vigorous churchgoer, even as president. But let's now start to talk about where the political expedience and the sort of spiritual come together.
It's interesting. If you look at him in his early days in the 1830s and early 1840s, when he was in the state legislature, he seems not to have really been very discreet about his irreligiosity. He clearly spoke freely about it with friends and associates. I would say it's not even that it was a well-kept secret. It was a pretty open understanding. At one point, he purportedly wrote a handbill, authored one anyway, in which he disproved the divinity of Christ, and his friends threw it in the fire because they believed that this would be disastrous for him personally, business-wise, and politically. The first moment when he seems to realize he'd better at least give a nod toward the community was in 1846 when he runs for Congress. He's running against Peter Cartwright, who was a Democrat and a very famous Methodist circuit rider and minister who happened to live in the same district.
So a circuit rider would be like a guy who literally got on his horse and went from church to church?
Right. He's an evangelist for the Methodist Church. This is how the early Methodist Church organized itself. He would, you know, ride from town to town along a particular circuit that the bishop had assigned him. And he would, you know, hold prayer meetings. He would hold revivals. He would convert people to Methodism. The Methodist Church had a brilliant kind of organizational scheme by which it sort of subdivided up the country and into different circuits. And that is how they, you know, they were in fierce competition with Baptists for new converts to Christianity. So Cartwright was a pretty famous circuit rider and Methodist clergyman. You know, he was a guy whose strength was to stand up in front of a congregation or a prayer meeting and hold everyone in rapture. And there was also a lot of similarity between political meetings and religious revivals in this period. A lot of people noted the similarity between them in terms of tactics and tone and feeling. Another example of how, you know, popular democracy grows up alongside evangelical Protestantism. But in any event, you know, they're running against each other. Lincoln is the Whig candidate and Cartwright's the Democratic nominee. And these rumors that Lincoln was an infidel and the author of this handbill are hounding him, dogging him throughout the race. And he's forced to put out a statement in which he says that he's never been a religious scoffer. He acknowledges that he's not a particularly observant person, but he himself would never want to vote for somebody who was a religious scoffer. He's careful not to say that he believes in God. He certainly doesn't, and he doesn't want to be pinned to that. But he does try to like smooth the edges around. But after 1846, really up until 1860, he stays very tight-lipped about religion. He stops talking about it publicly and privately. And, you know, he spends a good amount of time trying to overcome his reputation in central Illinois as a scoffer.
So was he a child of the Enlightenment born 100 years too late?
I think that's possible. I think that he was probably born 30 or 40 years too late. I mean, he, in the sense that I think his religious convictions lined up closer with Thomas Jefferson's. I think it's fair to say that he certainly didn't believe in the divinity of Christ. He didn't believe in the Trinity. He didn't believe in a personal God, which was, you know, very much a staple of evangelical Protestantism in this period. People believe they had a personal relationship with Christ, with God. He believes there's a force in the world that's a guiding hand. He believes in something called the doctrine of necessity, which basically says that there's something, there's some force that governs the scope of human action and that humans have some agency, but that, you know, there's this invisible, almost sort of invisible four walls that dictate how far they can go and where they can go. But he doesn't believe in a personal God in a sense that would have been recognizably evangelical Protestant. So I guess, to be fair, he's not an atheist per se, but he's closer to being a deist in that sense. And he read a lot of Jefferson. He read a lot of Thomas Paine. So this was born of, I think, considered study.
So now we're approaching the presidency in 1860. As that goes, so are the heightening tensions between the North and the South over the slavery issue, which was deliberately drawn into the Constitution, the Compromise of 1820, Missouri Compromise. Then you have things like Dred Scott. This is all a fight over the institution in of itself of slavery, but also its expansion in the United States. You know, the Republican Party in 1854 is founded on the idea that slavery should not be expanded, but also that, you know, slavery should be done away with. There's a strong abolition movement in the North, but that doesn't necessarily equate to equality between the races, right? Just that one man should not hold another in bondage. So let's talk about this. So as the tension of the country is rising and Lincoln is rising with it, talk to us a little bit about how he starts to turn towards the Bible, of which he became an avid reader and an even more avid quoter. He never missed an opportunity to cite a passage out of the Bible.
That's right. If you look at Lincoln's, you know, public speeches and letters before 1860, on occasion you will capture a reference to God or the Almighty, but very, very, very rarely. This starts to change right around the time he's elected president. And I think what's important to note, though, is that, to your point, there is a rising abolitionist movement in the United States in the 1840s and 50s. It is avowedly evangelical and Protestant. So on one hand, most evangelical Protestants are not abolitionists, but almost all abolitionists are ardent evangelicals, and their religious commitments inform their abolitionism and drive it. At the same time, you also have, to your point, a political anti-slavery movement that does not align itself with the abolitionists. These are people who oppose the expansion of slavery into the territories, but they don't necessarily morally disapprove of slavery or believe in equality between the races. A lot of those people were also brought to the anti-slavery conviction through religious belief as well. Lincoln emerges after several years of political slumber in 1854 as a man on fire about slavery. I mean, he becomes the antecedent, I guess, of a one-issue politician. I mean, he's a single-issue politician in the extreme. He believes slavery is wrong. He believes that it's a crime against humanity. He believes that it's theft. The sincerity of his anti-slavery position is can't even be doubted. But at the same time, his opposition to slavery has almost no rooting in religion whatsoever. Unlike abolitionists, unlike most of his fellow anti-slavery Republicans who kind of emerge as a party between 1854 and 56, this is just not a consideration for him. But by 1860, you see him beginning to incorporate very familiar biblical phrases and language in his speeches. There are more references to the Almighty, to God, to the guiding hand. And I think two things are going on. One thing it's worth noting, and we haven't done that here, that although Lincoln was not religious in the conventional sense, not Christian in the conventional sense, Mary Todd Lincoln later said her husband was not a technical Christian, but he was an avid Bible reader. Lincoln read not widely, but deeply. So like his law partner, William Herndon, had an enormous collection of books and periodicals he subscribed to. Lincoln didn't read most of them. You know, Herndon remembered Lincoln as someone who would read, you know, 10 things 100 times over. And the Bible was one of them. So even if he was not conventionally religious, he knew the Bible chapter and verse. He knew the stories. He knew the language. And that language, remember, was the King James Bible, the version that was Elizabethan kind of English, all the thous and thus. And it sounds Shakespearean because that King James version was done, you know, in Elizabethan England. It's the same English. He knew it really well. And I think by the late 1850s, early 1860s, he comes to appreciate that the language of the King James Bible, the stories of the King James Bible, they can help him explain to a political audience in terms they would understand and that would resonate with them ideas that he wanted to convey. This is really remarkable. I mean, I think people in the, you know, if you think back about 20 years, people noted that George W. Bush had a preternatural sort of ability to use language that would resonate with evangelicals. And I think that you see Lincoln doing that by 1860 in much the same way because he understands his audience and he just happens to be very well versed in the one text that they, you know, will resonate with them.
Right. And obviously there's the famous biblical passage, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. But go south of the Mason-Dixon line, and there is a massive religious movement in which slavery is ordained by God. And they pick out their passages from the Bible to say, here is why slavery is a good, and in fact, was part of the reason why the country was founded. It was baked into it from the get-go, and it is ordained by God. So you have Lincoln and his spiritual awakening. And then you have the South, where it is now utilizing religion to defend its position.
That's exactly right. Remember that the major evangelical churches split along North-South lines in the 1840s. First, it was the Presbyterians, then the Methodists, then the Baptists. And although the churches had for several decades been nominally anti-slavery, they had tolerated slave owners and slave holding, in part because they simply could not afford to write off half of the country and the border states where they were hoping to attract converts. But that split occurs in the 1840s, and you see the northern and southern branches of these three main evangelical denominations moving further and further from each other theologically and politically. And it wasn't just that the southern churches cherry-picked the pieces from the Bible that would seem to justify slavery, while the northern churches cherry-picked the pieces of it that would seem to augur against it. You know, in many ways, the northern evangelical churches became more engaged in social reform, and then later during the Civil War in politics, whereas the Southern churches really kind of hardened their position that the role of clergy and the role of the church was to save souls, to convert people, and to see to their spiritual well-being, and that churches should not meddle in politics. And beginning with a whole raft of social reform movements, including abolitionism in the 1840s and 50s, and then certainly during the war when the churches really become in the North mainstays of both the war effort and later the Republican Party, you see the church embracing a much more kind of socially and politically activist point of view.
So 1861, March 4th, 1861, Lincoln takes office. His first inaugural goes down as one of the greatest inaugural speeches, maybe one of the best of all time. The Gettysburg Address, his second inaugural. As he's in office now, thousands of men dying, tens of thousands of men dying every month. He comes to see himself as God's instrument.
That's exactly right. What's interesting is we know the following based on Lincoln's private conversations, based on a memorandum that he actually wrote to himself just to sort of get his thoughts on paper, and based on some of his correspondence with religious delegations, is that he comes during the course of the war to believe that the conflict has been divinely ordained and that he has a particular role to play, but he doesn't know what that role is. It's obviously to try to win the war, and eventually he comes to believe that emancipating the slaves, eradicating slavery is part of the role he has to play, but he's not particularly certain that the North will win the war, that God wants the North to win the war. He comes to believe that the war itself is kind of God's way of punishing both the North and the South for their transgression.
But that's an important piece, I think, because as you noted, he believed that it might be God's retribution for slavery, but that didn't necessarily mean the North was favored in the eyes of the Lord.
That's exactly right. I mean, during the war, you see Protestant clergymen and lay leaders and just ordinary Christians, whether they're soldiers or on the home front, really coming to embrace the idea that this is a holy war, that they're on God's side, the Union is on God's side, and God is on the Union's side, and that God wills this war to be won by the North. And eventually, many people come to believe that, you know, many Christians come to believe that it's also a war to end slavery, and that is what God wants. Lincoln is convinced that this whole thing is a divine and historical drama, and that he has a central role and has been chosen to play that central role. And he believes that part of his central role is to eradicate slavery, but he does not necessarily believe that God's going to reward the North with a victory. He thinks both sides are being punished, and it's entirely possible that the North could lose that war. So he never shares the certainty of most evangelical Protestants in the North that somehow God's on their side, they're on God's side, and that justice will win out in the end. Because he doesn't believe in a personal God, he believes in this distant, kind of unknowable force. It's hard for him to share their certainty. He becomes increasingly religious, but he does not become evangelical. He learns to speak the language of evangelical Christianity, but never shares some of its fundamental tenets and faith.
Let me ask about the balance of the North in the context of Lincoln and the Civil War. Did at any point Northerners, the Union, religious leaders, did they see Lincoln as ordained by God to be in the position he was in?
They did. I mean, there's this interesting confluence. You see many, many clergymen and lay leaders saying that Lincoln's been chosen by God to be in this position. You know, they kind of say the quiet part out loud, whereas he does not. He doesn't run around saying, I'm God's instrument. We know he believed it, but he didn't quite yell it from the rafters. But unlike Lincoln, again, they believe that God has a plan and that they know exactly what God's plan is and what Lincoln's role in it is. Whereas for Lincoln, he doesn't. He really doesn't. You know, one of the interesting things is Mary noted that he became more religious after their son Willie died, and particularly by the time that he gave the Gettysburg Address a year and a half later. And it's pretty easy to develop a sense that, you know, on some level, he felt that Willie's death, which was just terrible for the Lincolns, that it was his personal cross to bear, literally. You know, God was punishing the whole country for slavery, but this was, you know, his particular cross to bear. So we know that there's this religious sentiment that's sort of swelling up in him, but he remains completely unconvinced that he could possibly know what God's intent and will is. And what's so interesting about that is that in some fashion, although he's learning to speak the language of evangelical Protestantism, and by 1864, he really kind of like taps into the religious community during his reelection campaign, and he's certainly trying to mobilize the churches on behalf of the war effort, recognizing how important they can be. All of this is true, but he's moving in an opposite direction from most of the country, which is evangelical. He's actually in a bizarre way moving back closer to his father's religion, you know, not quite literally. He's not a hard shell Baptist or anything, but he does come to believe in a certain fatalism and a view of the world where he only has a limited scope and agency. And at the end of the day, it's this unknowable God who's going to decide what happens. And no human can change that. We can just play the part that we were chosen to play by that God. It's very interesting.
Or maybe, you know, comparing himself to Job, right, in the trials. How much do I have to put up with? How much is God going to test me on these things? So really more of an Old Testament look at the world.
Yes, more of an Old Testament view of the world. And what I found fascinating when researching this book was that evangelical Protestants, really in the first half of the first five, six decades of the 19th century, their reference point was the New Testament. You know, because this is all about a personal relationship with Christ. It's a message of redemption and Christian love. And, you know, the New Testament is better for that, right?
Well, because the Old Testament has a lot of vengeful God in it.
There's a lot of smiting. You know, people get smote in the Old Testament. And there's wars between nations, which is one of the reasons that during the early 1860s, for most Protestant churchgoers, they start to turn back to the Old Testament, not only because many of the stories about warring nations, those are interesting reference points, but also the kind of Old Testament violence and justice. And the idea that violence could be a legitimate Christian act, you know, in the right circumstances, which was sort of in conflict with notions of Christian love, it becomes much more compelling. And it's not just that we see clergymen referencing the Old Testament more and more. It's also that a lot of them sort of literally stood up and gave sermons where they said, you know, before 1860, before this war started, the New Testament seemed much more befitting to a Christian community. But now we really need to look back at the Old Testament. And what I found fascinating about that was that not only was Lincoln so well versed in the Old Testament and comfortable invoking it to sort of help frame and help people understand the war, it was putting white evangelicals in much closer step with black evangelicals. Because remember, we think of these churches as white, but there was an enormous, particularly in the North, evangelical Christianity, Protestantism was as rife in the free black communities as it was in the white communities. But, you know, evangelical Christians like Frederick Douglass had always viewed the Old Testament as more of a reference point. Because first of all, you know, the story of the Exodus is certainly resonant for, you know, ex-slaves and free African Americans. But at the same time, it was more conducive to an embrace of coercion and violence in the cause of abolitionism. And you see white evangelicals during the war embracing that same Old Testament reference in a way that helped them to justify and make sense of the violence that they were compelled to commit in the service of preserving the Union and freeing slaves. Because people weren't just looking for a way to justify the war. They were looking for a way to understand the war. Because for hundreds of thousands of soldiers, and then for millions more of their family members, how to reconcile the fact that you might die or that you're committing unspeakable acts of violence, that you're a farm boy who was raised on an ethos of Christian love and compassion, and you're now being asked to bayonet someone in a battle, you need a frame of reference to understand that. You need a frame of reference to understand what the death of your loved ones meant. And so, you know, I wanted to take care in this book to make clear that it's not that people are like just using religion to justify their actions. They're using it to understand what their role in this divine plot is in the same way that Lincoln was. And they really had to rethink, you know, fundamental tenets of Christian faith. For instance, prior to the war, most Christians' conception of what happened after you died did not at all resemble what, you know, many Christians today believe or what people during the war came to believe. You kind of went to a ethereal kind of state. It was like a liminal place where all worldly cares and concerns and pain and really like understanding or even consciousness disappeared. During the war, Christians came to embrace an idea of heaven as really like it's the Victorian home and family beyond. You're going to get reunited in the family parlor with your lost son or with your lost mother. It gives them a way of kind of persevering through all this loss. And the Lincolns themselves struggled with it after Willie died as well. People hone in on Mary Lincoln's flirtations with spiritualism, and they look at it as maybe Mary's eccentricism, but like spiritualism was actually a pretty widely respected or at least widely practiced or flirted with theology in the 1860s during the war. Everybody from, you know, Queen Elizabeth to some of Lincoln's cabinet members also flirted with spiritualism. Believing that you could commune with the dead was not that far off from believing that somehow you were going to be reunited with them in the family parlor or something resembling your Victorian home when you died. So Christianity gives millions of Northern evangelicals a way to understand the war, but the war is also changing evangelical Christianity at the same time as well.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because I don't want our conversation to end before we zoom out from the death of Lincoln, the end of the Civil War, and zoom back into what, if any, similarities you see between evangelicalism of that time and what we see now. Because now it seems that the evangelical churches line up almost exclusively with conservative political causes, and that the Venn diagram is really more of a circle, that they take a deep interest in politics, that there is a fight for good and evil, that God is on one side and it's not on yours, but also, you know, the broader religious nature of the country. You know, just reading this today, about 70% of Americans consider themselves religious, about 63% of them Christian. But in the early 90s, it was 95%, right? So, I mean, you're losing 10% of the country a decade that consider themselves religious, which maybe that's a reason why those that do consider themselves religious are maybe that much more faithful.
I mean, obviously, there's a 160-year gulf between then and now, between the 1860s and the 2020s, and we're more pluralistic today. It's not a Christian nation in the way that it was in the 1840s or 50s. And evangelical Protestantism has obviously changed in vast ways. But I think the precedent that Lincoln and his generation set was that the war opened up an opportunity for evangelical Protestants to play in politics and to erode that wall that once existed between the spiritual and the secular. You know, in the 1850s or 40s, it wasn't like secular people were saying there's no role for religion in politics. It was religious people who believed that. They truly believed that the churches had a particular role, and that was seeing to the spiritual well-being of Christians and converting them and helping them lead good Christian lives, and that with the exception of some reform movements, that the churches should stay out of politics. By the 1860s, with Lincoln's, you know, active encouragement, the churches are becoming increasingly vocal in their support of the war. They're becoming increasingly partisan. The ministers on an individual level and the church organizations at the organizational level are openly endorsing Republican candidates. They're openly endorsing Lincoln in 1864. They're stumping for him. So in every which way, the Civil War era in the North creates this precedent for Christians to view religion as a legitimate force in politics and in public affairs. We could look at that in the 1860s and say, well, this was a really good thing. And obviously Lincoln understood that this was, you know, by motivating the Christian base, he was going to help win the war and also maintain Republican Party control of the government, which was so essential to winning the war and freeing the slaves. But that precedent then, you know, by the post-war era, it can express itself in really liberal Christian activism of the social gospel vein, you know, with in the 1890s and early 1900s, everything from the Settlement House movement to, you know, really forward-looking progressive reform movements, which were rooted in social gospel Protestantism. It can also express itself in a really kind of regressive and conservative way. You also saw Christian reform movements in the late 19th century trying to police people's sexual activities, trying to police their consumption of alcohol. So it can be just as regressive as progressive. And this has waxed and waned over the years, but I would argue that after the Civil War, the idea that Christians could play in politics and weigh in as Christians in politics never really eroded. So that's something that switches on in the 1860s, and I don't think by and large is switched off.
No, and I think that it would be hard for a candidate who has national ambitions to have no connection to religion, to say, okay, yeah, I'm an agnostic. Okay, that's fine. But, you know, there's an expectation that, you know, you're going to put your hand on a Bible. You're going to swear before God to uphold and defend the Constitution. You know, President Biden, I think, goes to services almost every weekend, if not every weekend. As you mentioned, President George W. Bush was very devout in his faith. But there's always been, maybe for some modern American politicians, a Lincoln-esque nod to religion that I might not be fully immersed in this, but I know I can't win without it.
And I think that Lincoln, he's always an iconoclast, right? So he lives in this evangelical world, and he governs an evangelical nation through this war. And he's the first president who really knows how to capture the Christian vote, to speak the language of the Bible, to motivate and mobilize the churches and the clergy. You know, he does it 120 years before Ronald Reagan went to the religious roundtable and said, I know you can't endorse me legally, but I endorse you. Lincoln understood intuitively how to mobilize the Christian base, how to mobilize the clergy, the churches. He is in many ways, although not an evangelical Christian by any meaning of the word, Lincoln was the first president to really understand how to mobilize Christians as Christians on behalf of a political and secular agenda, and that the war, you know, itself was the first moment when Christianity really kind of asserted itself in the public sphere. That is true. But on the flip side, you know, the war also changed the nature of evangelical Protestantism. It made it a more bellicose religion, at least for a time. You know, Christians lost something by allowing that wall between the secular and the sacred to erode. And I think that, you know, today, conservative evangelicals in the same way are asserting their right to bring religion into the political sphere. That is true. But politics is also changing and molding their religion in ways which, you know, to many observers is pretty disturbing. And so it's a push and pull. It's not Christianity changes politics. It's also politics in the 1860s changed Christianity in the same way that it's doing the same today.
Well, look, I mean, I think that this is the fascinating thing about American history, is that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it does often echo. And I think we're starting to see some of that echo and some of the admittedly 160-year downstream effects of things like this. Well, Josh, I want to thank you for joining me today. Where can everybody find your work, and where can they find you online?
Terrific. So if you want to follow me on Twitter, as long as Twitter continues to exist, it's at Joshua M. Zeitz. And, you know, Lincoln's God is coming out in May, but you can pre-order it on Amazon or at Viking Press, which is an imprint of Random House, has published it. And then I would also just add, I'm also a contributor to a book that was just released or just published this week called Myth America. And it's a collection of essays by 20 historians who take on in each chapter a different myth about American history. And they kind of give you a sense of how that myth came to be, and they help give you a new frame for thinking about these topics. So everything from the New Deal and the Great Society to the Reagan Revolution and American exceptionalism and American empire. And you can find that on Amazon or really anywhere books are sold.
Great. As always, gang, you can find me on Twitter and TikTok at Reed Galen. And you'd find me on Instagram at Reed_Galen_LP. Josh Zeitz, I want to thank you for joining me today, and everybody else, we'll see you next time. Thanks again to everyone for listening. Be sure to follow and subscribe to The Lincoln Project on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or however you listen. Don't forget to leave a 5-star review. To connect with us, follow us on Twitter, at Project Lincoln, and for more information on our movement, to join our mailing list, subscribe to our newsletter, or make a contribution to our efforts, visit lincolnproject.us. If you want to message the podcast directly, please send an email to podcast@lincolnproject.us. And if you want to personally join the fight to save our nation's democracy, visit jointheunion.us. For The Lincoln Project, I'm Reed Galen. I'll see you on the next episode.